Now let's go to the middle chapter of the unit, which has a couple, starts with a couple important historical experiments, important in the history of learning what DNA is and learning that DNA is the genetic material. So before I talk about this first experiment, let me say that it's only fairly recently that we knew what the hell DNA is and what it's all about. You know, even people who've never taken a biology course nowadays know about DNA. It's the most famous molecule in the world, probably. Or big molecule. But anyway, this wasn't always the case. DNA is, of course, a nucleic acid. So it's one of the four biological macromolecules. Well, before we knew what DNA did and how it did it, we knew that it existed eventually. I mean, there are days before that when we didn't even know it existed. But chemically, we could see that it was there. So we had the four categories of biological macromolecules much longer than we knew about those four categories much longer than we knew about what DNA actually does. And when we, in the early days of genetics, when we were trying to figure out what causes inheritance, heredity, how are traits passed on, which we've known for millennia, right? For thousands of years, humans have known, well, traits get passed on from parents to offspring. But for most of those thousands of years, they had no idea how, so just fairly recently. And so in these earlier days of modern biology, we were still needing to demonstrate that the basis for heredity is a particle. Right? You have to first demonstrate, before you can even say that it's DNA, you have to first say, well, that it's some sort of chemical. That's what's doing the heredity. That's what's being passed on. And this first slide is important in that history. It's the so-called Griffith's experiment. You don't have to know that it's Griffith, but this was done in the 20s, late 20s. And it's the first experimental evidence of what's called bacterial transformation, which I'll explain in a minute. But let's first look at how this experiment was conducted. So this involves non-volunteer mice that were exposed to different bacteria. Now, there are two different strains of this bacterium, the S strain and the R strain. So they're it's kind of like different breeds of dog. They're basically the same species, but different strains. And drastically different in their effects on humans. The S strain is the dangerous strain. S stands here for smooth, how they look under a scope. But the S strain causes pneumonia in mammals, including the mice that were used. The R strain, on the other hand, is non-virulent. It does not cause pneumonia. So it's, from our point of view, it's no problem. Well, notice what they did here. They injected living S cells, S bacteria, that's the dangerous one, into mice, and not surprisingly, those mice died. In another group, they injected living R cells. And since that's the harmless type, not surprisingly, those mice lived. Okay. Then in this third group, they injected more mice, but first they heat killed the S cells. They took the dangerous ones, but made sure that they killed them by boiling it first, and then injected the dead S cells into the mouse. And once again, not surprisingly, even though it was the dangerous stuff, the mouse lived because it was dead dangerous cells. The interesting one is the fourth one. Here they took heat-killed S cells, those are the dangerous ones, but dead, and then they mixed those with living, harmless R cells and injected that mixture. And the mouse died, even though there were no living S cells in that. And that's because the R cells that were alive still had transformed into S cells. That's why this is the first demonstration of something that we call bacterial transformation. What happens in transformation is that under the right circumstances, just naked DNA that has been released by rupture of cells that are dead, just DNA in the environment, can be taken up by bacteria and then used as its own DNA, like it had that DNA originally. So the DNA of the harmful bacteria was taken up by the R, and that transformed them into the S strain. They had new traits. Well, they didn't know this detail at the time, but this is important in the history of figuring out DNA, because it really demonstrates that there is a particle of inheritance. There is a chemical that can determine your traits, because these R cells, these R bacteria, did not have that trait until they were exposed to that chemical. All right, so like I said, they didn't know that it was DNA at the time, but it demonstrates that there is a particle of inheritance. All right, well, on to two. This is background for another important experiment that happened in the 40s. These three TV alien-looking things in teal are viri. There's all kinds of different viri or viruses. These are called bacteriophages. Notice how it has the same root as in phagocytosis, which means cell eating, that we talked about, vesicular transport. Bacteriophage, importantly... Whoops, what am I doing? A bacteriophage is not a bacterium. A bacteriophage is a virus that can invade a bacterium. So just quickly, let's just discuss a virus, because I haven't really brought viruses up since the first day when we were talking about what it means to be alive. Right, a virus is not alive. It's not an organism, definitely, right? Why is it not an organism?
It's not a cell.
Right. To be an organism, you have to have at least one cell. And a virus isn't much smaller than even the tiniest cells. It doesn't have a plasma membrane. It doesn't have a cytoplasm. It doesn't have metabolism. It really, at the simplest kinds of viruses, are just a collection of two of the four kinds of macromolecules. It's a DNA or an RNA, so a nucleic acid, wrapped by protein as a capsule around it. They can't do anything on their own, but they can fool cells, in a sense, or cells get fooled into creating copies of new viruses if they get infected by the virus. So it takes an organism for a virus, which is not an organism, to reproduce. And different viri have different hosts, which is why we can get certain viral diseases that other organisms can't, that are immune to, right? Well, bacteriophages are simply viruses that have as their hosts bacteria. They invade bacteria. And we have three shown here that are on the surface of a bacterium. So the brown is the bacterial cell. You're seeing just a tiny part of it. It's really huge. It shows you how small a virus actually is. Much, much smaller than a cell. Bacterial cells are already much smaller than eukaryotic cells. Okay, anyway, you can see that DNA is being injected into this bacterial cell. Now, we didn't know this before the experiment that I'm just about to tell you. We didn't know what got injected. But bacteriophages were chosen for this experiment for this reason. Back in these days, we had already shown that there is a particle of inheritance, right? That was the previous experiment. So once we showed that, the immediate next question is, well, since there is a particle of inheritance, what is it? And, you know, it could be anything, but just it was reasonable to not give everything a fair chance, right? So we quickly discounted tiny things like water. It's unlikely to be a water molecule or a hydrogen atom. So most biologists at the time said it's very likely one of the four complex biological molecules, the macromolecules. So you have the four candidates, right? Lipids, polysaccharides, polypeptides, and nucleic acids. Like I said, we knew that all four of those existed just from chemical testing, but we didn't know what nucleic acids did. We just knew that they were a biological macromolecule. So for various reasons, they narrowed it down even farther and said it's pretty unlikely that it is lipids. And it's also fairly unlikely that it's polysaccharides. Not that it's impossible, but they were trying to make it a more manageable task to figure it out. So they set those aside, lipids and polysaccharides. And that left the two, proteins and nucleic acids. The reason that they included proteins is because at the time, most biologists just assumed it was going to turn out to be proteins. Their reasoning basically was, for anything to control anything so complex as inheritance, that particle itself must be very complex, and therefore proteins is probably what it is. So they included that in the ones to be tested, proteins, and they expected it to be proteins, most of them, most of the biologists. But they also included nucleic acids, which includes DNA and RNA, simply because they didn't know what else it did. So they said, we don't know what this is, let's test this. All right. So it really boiled down to trying to determine whether it's one or the other of those two, protein and DNA. And this is exactly why they chose a bacteriophage to answer this question. Because a bacteriophage consists of only those two things, DNA and protein. All right? So that's what we're looking at here. Let's look at the experiment that they conducted. To do this experiment, this is really, really well designed. To do the experiment, though, they needed to be able to tell where each of these two components of the virus were at any moment. They needed, in other words, to label the two different kinds of material. And that involved running two different batches. Because in one batch, the pink stuff here, they used radioactive isotopes of sulfur to label, this is called radio labeling, the protein. Okay, now why sulfur? Because there is no sulfur in DNA. But there is sulfur in some amino acids, and therefore there's sulfur in protein. And if you have only radioactive sulfur as the version of sulfur in the environment, then that's the kind of sulfur that's going to be incorporated into the proteins. All right? So the viruses that they allowed to get replicated in this only radioactive sulfur environment got loaded with radioactive sulfur in their proteins, and therefore, since they can detect the radioactivity, they could detect where the protein is at any given moment. On the other batch, the blue one, they needed a way to label the DNA. So for that, they used radioactive phosphorus. Now, why is that a good choice for labeling DNA? That's right. A polynucleotide, which is DNA, consists of many, many nucleotides, right? And each individual nucleotide, no matter what the nitrogenous base is, has a phosphate, which of course includes a phosphorus atom. So if you have radioactive phosphorus only and not regular phosphorus, then all of the DNA has to be made out of that radioactive stuff. And so this batch had labeled DNA, the blue labeled the DNA, the pink labeled the protein. And then after they had those two separate batches, they did exactly the same thing for both of them, which is they allowed the bacterial cells to be infected by these viruses that grew up in this environment. And then in each batch, they separately put them into what turned out to be the perfect tool, laboratory tool for this, which was just an ordinary bar blender. Because the reason it was perfect is because they needed something to break apart the shell that's left on the bacterium after whatever it was, they didn't know at the time, got injected. That empty part that is still connected to the bacterium, they needed to remove that. But they needed to stir it vigorously to knock them off. But they also needed it to not be so vigorous a stirring that it would rupture the bacterial cells. They had to keep the cells alive and undamaged, just knock the shells off. And the blender did the trick. Okay, you can see the shells being knocked off here. They did that in both batches. The only difference is the pink one, the protein was labeled, and the blue one, the DNA was labeled. Then they exposed each to centrifugation, spun them in a centrifuge, which creates huge forces, many, many G's, and therefore the heaviest stuff falls to the bottom of the tube. Okay, well, the heaviest stuff by far is the bacterial cells. And so the pellet at the bottom consists of all the living bacterial cells. The stuff that floats above it is called the supernatant, and in this case, that included all of the shells that had been knocked off. For both batches, it's the heaviest one in both batches is the cells. But then they detected the radioactivity. And in the pink version, the radioactivity was only in the supernatant floating above. That demonstrated that the protein was the shell part, right? And therefore was not the thing that got injected, therefore was not the genetic material, which they expected. I mean, they expected it to be the genetic material. This showed that it wasn't. And in the other one, all of the radioactivity was in the pellet, in the cells. The DNA was in the cell, so it was that this proved pretty definitively, because of the good design, that DNA is the genetic material. And so, like I said, this happened in the 40s, but even scientists are sometimes hard to convince. And so some of the biologists at the time said, okay, well, this demonstrates that DNA is the genetic material for bacteria. But for something complex like a human, I still think it's protein. Well, eventually they came around, and we know it's DNA for all organisms, not just bacteria. So let's then go on to four and take a closer look at DNA molecularly. This is kind of review at this point, but it's been a while since we talked about it. DNA is a nucleic acid. That's what the NA stands for, right? DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid. And therefore, it is a polymer, right? Nucleic acids, polysaccharides, and polypeptides are the three kinds of macromolecules that are polymers. Lipids are not. Polymers are large molecules that are built by hooking together a bunch of subunits. They can be a bunch of the same subunit, like for cellulose or glycogen, right? It's just glucose over and over. Or they can be different kinds of subunits, like in a polypeptide, different amino acids. But in any case, a polymer is built that way, one subunit at a time hooked together. Well, in four, we're looking at just a tiny fraction of an overall DNA polynucleotide. This is why, by the way, the blue kind of fades off at the top and the bottom, to show you that this is just four nucleotides of what would be millions, just a single DNA in a chromosome, just one strand, not even both strands, just one strand, one polynucleotide is millions of nucleotides long. So they're enormous molecules in terms of polymers. This just shows you four because, well, for one reason, that there are four different kinds of nitrogenous bases that DNA uses, right? So one of each is shown here. But they can be in any sequence. Let's recall, though, what a nucleotide is. A nucleotide contains three parts, right? One part, so this kind of central part of a nucleotide, is a pentose sugar. So it's not only a sugar, it's a pentose because it has five carbons. And that's true for any nucleic acid. But in the case of DNA, specifically, the sugar is what? It's not just any pentose, it's a specific pentose. Deoxyribose, exactly. If it's an RNA nucleotide, this sugar would be ribose, which is why RNA stands for ribonucleic acid. The only difference between the two, this is deoxyribose that we see here. If this were ribose, this would be OH instead of H. And so deoxyribose gets its name because it's just like oxygen without one of the oxygen. I mean, just like ribose without one of the oxygens. Deoxyribose. All right? So that's an important point. In a polynucleotide, which is many nucleotides hooked together, every one of the sugars is the same. In other words, if you're building a DNA, every one of the nucleotides has to have deoxyribose as the sugar. If you're building an RNA, every one of the nucleotides has to have ribose as a sugar. It's not mix and match. Okay, but so that's one, that's the central part of a nucleotide, which is just one subunit. That sugar, which since we're talking about DNA, is deoxyribose, is then connected to two different things at two different places. It's connected to a phosphate at its 5' carbon, as it's called. Simply the fifth carbon. Oxygen is here, so not all five of these points of the pentagon are carbons. When you have something else listed as a symbol, that means it's not carbon, right? If it's not listed, then it's carbon. But this is oxygen. You can kind of think of that as the zero position because then it starts 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 5 hangs off of that ring. But anyway, at the 5' carbon, as it's called, that's where you have a phosphate connected. And at the 1st carbon, you have the third component of the nucleotide, which is a nitrogenous base of some sort. Now, that's an important phrase, of some sort, because if we're talking about DNA, just like I said a minute ago, you know that the sugar has to be deoxyribose. There's no variability. Also, all phosphates are the same, so there's no variability in phosphates. And therefore, the only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides, which is the only reason why there is information in DNA, because the sequence can be anything since you have different kinds of nucleotides, is that the nitrogenous base can be any of four choices. It can be adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine for DNA. You see what I mean? You see what I meant there by the information? If there was only one kind of nucleotide, because these don't vary, the phosphates don't vary, the sugars don't vary, and if the nitrogenous base was only one type, then that wouldn't give you much information, right? You had a sequence of identical nucleotides. That's not really a code for anything. But since there are four choices of nitrogenous base, there are therefore four kinds of nucleotides that can be in any order, not just this order. And that's what the information is that that DNA carries, the actual sequence of nucleotides. All right? Now, this blue background shaded here is important because that information that DNA is carrying only remains useful information if that sequence is intact. Right? In other words, the sequence can be anything, but for it to be a lasting code, you can't mix that sequence up once it's there. Which means, molecularly speaking, you have to keep this strand, which is the polynucleotide, together. You can't let it break apart because then you lose the information that's in the sequence. Well, what's holding this polynucleotide together along its length is only bonding between the phosphate of one nucleotide and the sugar of the next nucleotide. And then that second nucleotide's phosphate is connected to the sugar of the next one, and so on. So what's shown in blue shading is the so-called sugar-phosphate backbone. Because it's sugar, phosphate, all the way down the length of the polynucleotide. That is really important because if you break this thing apart, you no longer have the information, right? And that's why it's important for the bonds to be strong, to keep that strand together. Well, these sugar phosphate bonds are covalent bonds and therefore strong. It's difficult to break them, and therefore the information is held secure. The nitrogenous bases, which really provide the information, have nothing to do with keeping this strand together. They're just hanging off of the sugar phosphate backbone. They're not connected to each other. This is exactly analogous to R groups in polypeptides, right? The sequence in a polypeptide is important as well, because that determines the shape of the polypeptide once it's built, right? That primary structure, which is the sequence, is determines all the other levels of structure. But just like in a polynucleotide, the R groups of a polypeptide are not at all holding together that sequence. The only thing holding them together are the peptide bonds between the amino group and the carboxyl group of two adjacent amino acids. Not the R groups, they're just hanging off. Same thing here. Well, this is just one polynucleotide, however long it is. Like I said, it could be millions of nucleotides. That's not a complete DNA. A polynucleotide is a molecule by itself. And that's why I was saying last time that when we talk about one DNA, it's really two molecules. This is not a complete DNA because DNA usually is a double-stranded nucleic acid. So One DNA consists of two DNA polynucleotides that are associated with each other. They're not covalently hooked, otherwise that would just make a bigger molecule. And this is once again analogous to proteins, right? A multimeric protein is really multiple molecules, because each of the polypeptides in that multimeric protein, however many there are, two or more, is itself a complete molecule. But those complete polypeptides are then associated with each other to form the complex protein. Similarly with DNA, except it's exactly two, not two or more, two polynucleotide strands that are held together by hydrogen bonding, as we'll eventually see. Well, first though, we need to go back to history, and it wasn't until the 50s, you know, once we had the experiment I just talked about that demonstrated that DNA is the molecule of inheritance, then of course the big question is how what is its structure? Because before you can even hope to figure out how it works, you have to first know how it's built, what it looks like. And so that was in the late 40s, early 50s, the burning question that people were trying to answer. And slide 5 shows you Rosalind Franklin, who unfortunately at the time did not get credit for this, and she never did in her lifetime, because she died of cancer at 37, I think. But Watson and Crick got the Nobel Prize. Their names were much more famous than hers, but modern textbooks are at least now giving her credit, even though she's long dead. Anyway, Watson and Crick and Franklin eventually figured out that DNA is a double helical molecule, which you already knew because that's part of its fame. That was a big breakthrough, because once you know how it's built, you can figure out how it works. Well, Franklin's contribution was that she was an expert in what's called X-ray crystallography. This is a kind of a general technique that's used in chemistry to figure out the shapes of molecules. And you do that by bombarding the molecule with X-rays. You shine X-rays on them, and then on the other side you have the light, which is the X-ray, is invisible to us, but it's still light, the molecule, and then film. And the X-rays eventually hit the film, but they hit it in a way that depends on how they bounce off of the molecule. And that helps you figure out the shape. Well, this is a famous photograph of DNA being bombarded by X-rays. This is what the film looked like. And to most of us, that doesn't look like much, but Rosalind Franklin said, "Oh, well, this to me looks like it's a helical structure." And so that's what got Watson and Crick working along those lines to figure out how they could arrange a helix made out of the stuff they knew it was made out of, they just didn't know the shape, to come up with their famous model that they made. And so in 6, we can see a cartoon of this double helical model. So this is what I was saying we call one DNA, but it's really two polynucleotides. Each strand is one helix. A helix is a corkscrew shape, like a staircase. And the other separate polynucleotide is also a helix, so that's why we call it a double helix. The way this is drawn, it shows in blue as a ribbon the sugar phosphate backbone. This is reminding you of the fact that that's the only thing holding together this one strand, and it's the only thing holding together the other strand. The A's, T's, C's, and G's are the nitrogenous bases, but they're not at all holding together the length. They're just hanging off. But the way the double helix is arranged is that the if we untwist it, this is shown the way it actually occurs, but if you mentally untwist that, it becomes less like a spiral staircase and more like a ladder, right? Which is what we're looking at in the middle here, just a little section of ladder. So this is one sugar phosphate backbone holding together this polynucleotide, and this is the other polynucleotide held together by its own sugar phosphate backbone. The nitrogenous bases are just hanging off of that backbone, but what we see in the middle represented is the notion of complementarity. That's with an E, not an I. Complementarity of DNA refers to the fact that whatever nitrogenous base you have at a position in one polynucleotide, one of the strands, you have the so-called complementary nitrogenous base at that same position on the other strand. And adenine is complementary to thymine. So A always is associated with T in the other strand, and vice versa. C is always associated with G, and vice versa. All right? Now, what holds these two strands together, since they're separate molecules, separate polynucleotides, are what are represented by the magenta ellipses, these dots. Those are hydrogen bonds. Now, what do you know about hydrogen bonds as far as their strength? Yes, they are much, much weaker than covalent bonds, right? They're not even chemical bonds, which is why this is still two separate molecules. But they're stronger than nothing. And if you have millions of nucleotides, then you have millions of hydrogen bonds. That holds them together. But it holds them together comparatively loosely. The sugar phosphate backbone made out of covalent bonds needs to be strong so that the sequence remains intact, so you don't lose that information. But just as important for those bonds to be strong, it's also important for the bonds holding the two strands together to be weak and therefore easily broken. And that's because of something I told you last time. The two major functions of DNA are transcription and replication, right? And those are totally different things that are being accomplished in those processes, but both of them require separating the two strands from each other so that you can then read the sequence of one of the strands. Therefore, in order for DNA to work, you need to be able to separate these two strands, which means you need weak bonds holding them together. Hydrogen bonds are easily broken. And by the way, they will go right back together with hydrogen bonding once you're done reading them. And this is how DNA works as a library. Genes are just portions of the overall strand that you separate at that local place on the overall double helix. Read that sequence. That allows you to make an RNA that will allow you then to make a specific protein. But once you're done reading it, it's just like putting a book back on a shelf. These two strands naturally go back together and form hydrogen bonds between them. Okay, well, the same is true for replication. You have to separate the two strands in order for that to happen. So it's important for these hydrogen bonds to be weak. Seven. Now, before I talk about what's really shown in this slide, I should explain what the words purine and pyrimidine refer to. These ring structures are nitrogenous bases. So we've already talked about the fact that DNA uses adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine as its nitrogenous bases. And all four of those have one or two rings. Okay? But depending on whether there's one ring or two ring in the nitrogenous base, it can be classified as either a purine or a pyrimidine. The purines are the two ringers. And the pyrimidines are the one ringers. So of the four, cytosine and thymine are the pyrimidines. Let me go back to this picture to show you that. Notice that all the C's and all the T's have just one ring. Those are the pyrimidines. The purines are guanine and adenine. All the A's and all the G's have two rings. Okay? Now back to slide 7. By the way, I used to forget all the time which was which, purines and pyrimidines. And one day it dawned on me that the word pyrimidine has a Y in it, and so does thymine and cytosine, the two pyrimidines. So that might help you to remember. The other ones, guanine and adenine, do not have Ys, just like the word purine does not have a Y. Okay, but now to the point of this slide. There was a biologist by the name of Chargaff, who was studying all kinds of DNA from all kinds of organisms. He was just isolating the DNA from bacteria, whales, whatever. Huge variety of organisms. And what he found, one of the things he found, is that regardless of what organism you take DNA out of, there's the same amount of purine as there is pyrimidine. Which was kind of curious. Well, that led to what's called Chargaff's rules, which is that there's always the same amount of purine as there is pyrimidine in any DNA sample. Here's why. That ladder arrangement that I was talking about, if you think of a ladder, so this is untwisted, each pair of nitrogenous bases, which is why we call them base pairs, is like one rung of the ladder, right? Well, if you have a purine able to join with a purine, another purine, that means, since there are two ringers, that rung would be wide. And if you allow a pyrimidine and another pyrimidine to come together, that would be a narrow rung, right? So you wouldn't have a normal ladder, you would have a zigzag kind of ladder. On the other hand, if you only allow a purine and a pyrimidine at the same position but on the two strands to form a step of the ladder, they're all the steps are going to be the same width, just like in a ladder, like just like in an extension ladder. All right? So that explains why he found that. That way, the sugar phosphate backbones are the same distance apart, and regardless of what purine and pyrimidine you use, they're always going to be that same width. Well, that explains half of complementarity. Complementarity, though, is strict. There is strict complementarity, which means it's not enough to say that it's always purine with pyrimidine. In DNA, it is always adenine with thymine and always cytosine with guanine. Right? So it's more than just this width thing. Why is it that it's specifically A always with T and C always with G? Well, hopefully it's the next slide, if I'm thinking right, that shows you this. Yes, it is. Okay, this is slide 8. And this shows you why it's always A specifically with T and not G with T, which would still be purine and pyrimidine. And it's always G with C. The reason is that adenine and thymine are able to form two hydrogen bonds, whereas guanine and cytosine are able to form three hydrogen bonds. So C and G match up perfectly, and A and T match up perfectly in this respect. That's why it's not simply any purine and any pyrimidine together. It is specifically A with T and specifically G with C. Now, that strict complementarity is very important because, as we'll study when we look at transcription, when you're reading a gene, you're reading a sequence of nucleotides, a sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's. Well, those have to stand for a specific thing, right? It's because of strict complementarity, if you're reading an A on a strand that you're looking at, then the strand that you're going to be building has to be a T because of strict complementarity. So this strict complementarity is what gives the sequence its real value. It's unambiguous. Slide 9. When Watson and Crick in the 50s published their paper, which is really short, it's a really famous paper, but it's not very long, where they introduced the fact that that DNA occurs as a double helix and that it has this complementarity. It was just kind of an offhand final sentence that said something like, it has not escaped our attention that this complementarity could be a way for DNA to serve as a code for replication or something like that. I don't remember the exact sentence, which is kind of, it was an understatement the way it was done, because the fact that you have this strict complementarity is exactly why DNA is able to replicate itself. What it means is that since you have strict complementarity, like this double helix, this is just part of the double helix, because it's strict complementarity, wherever you have a C on either strand, the other strand at that same position is going to have a G. Wherever you have a T, the other strand is going to have an A, and so forth, right? Well, that means, if strict complementarity is obeyed, which it is, you could remove one of these two strands and hide it from me, and just let me read one strand, and I can tell you exactly what the sequence is on the other strand. Right? I simply have to put a T wherever there's an A G wherever there's a C, and so on. Just like these two separated strands. I only have to look at this to know what this is. And so this is why this is so valuable. It's because of strict complementarity. When you separate the two strands of a double helix in a DNA molecule, each of the individual strands serves as a template for how to make a copy of the other strand. Right? You read this strand, and it tells you, okay, I need a T, a G, an A, a T, and a C. You read this strand and it tells you, okay, I need an A, a C, a T, an A, and a G. And if you do that simultaneously, then you end up with two identical copies of the original double-stranded molecule. The dark blue here represents the original material. It's the original DNA. It's being separated into two strands. And then brand new light blue material is being laid down according to the rules of complementarity. Same thing with the other strand. Each strand is serving as a template for how to make a copy of the other strand. And when you do that simultaneously, you end up with two identical copies of double-stranded DNA that you started with. That's what happens in the S phase of the cell cycle. All right, I'm going to stop there.